Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Jade Helm 15, a military exercise involving the Special Forces, which is set to begin in July and has generated conspiracy theories on the fringes that have moved to the mainstream, with Texas Governor Greg Abbott ordering the Texas Guard to monitor the U.S. military and Texas Senator Ted Cruz expressing sympathy for the concerned patriots who distrust Obama, whose administration Cruz considers untrustworthy. Contributing writer to the Dallas Morning News, Wayne Slater, who has covered all the Texas governors from Bill Clements to Greg Abbott, joins us to discuss the phenomenon of right-wing politicians pandering to idiots. Then we will speak with award-winning former investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, Mark Feldstein, the chair of journalism at the University of Maryland. We'll discuss the press coverage of the recent shootout in Garland, Texas, that has been driven by the self-declared Islamic State, who have taken credit for the actions of two hapless wannabe jihadists, changing the focus of the story from one group of fanatics baiting another group of fanatics to the latest deadly chapter in the war on terror. Then finally, with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid holding hostage a vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal until an infrastructure package is passed and Pfizer is reformed, we will assess the fate of the TPP with Clyde Prestowitz, the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and author of The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. And joining us now is Wayne Slater, who's a contributing writer to the Dallas Morning News. He was 15 years as the Dallas Morning News' Austin bureau chief and is the co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. Wayne Slater has covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administrations of Texas Governors Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, Rick Perry, and now Greg Abbott. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne Slater.
Great to be with you, Ian, as always.
And it would seem, Wayne, that your current governor, the new governor, Greg Abbott, either believes these conspiracy theories about this military exercise that's taking place across a number of states, including Texas, the so-called Jade Helm 15 military exercise. He either believes the conspiracy theories that this is a sort of stalking horse for a government takeover of the country, or he's pandering to idiots. So which one is it?
Yeah, well, the pandering to idiots was the phrase that a former Republican legislator said in criticizing our governor's offering aid and comfort to the marginalia on the far right of the party. I think if I had to have a guess, Ian, it would be more the latter, that he understands the politics of this. What you have to understand, of course, is in a state like Texas, where the John Birch Society held philosophical sway on the far right in the 40s and 50s, you've long had this kind of birther, bircher, secessionist attitude, but most people don't give it any mind until this governor suggested that it maybe had some credence by saying he's going to call out the Guard to keep an eye on the military doing a training exercise. I think more than anything else, what that reflects is the governor felt comfortable saying what he did, announcing he was going to call out the Guard, the State Guard, to keep an eye on the military, because he felt that the Republican Party of Texas has shifted, especially in the last 15 years, particularly in the last 6 years under the Obama administration, so that it was safe to align yourself with such a radical and lunatic fringe.
Well, that's how he got elected, didn't he? I mean, wasn't Dewhurst a pretty much a shoo-in and an establishment guy? And he's about as right-wing as you could possibly want in any case. And suddenly this guy beats him on his right flank.
Yeah, this is clearly a part of the base of the Republican Party. It is not the entire Republican Party. There is, especially in rather wealthy sections of Dallas and Houston, an establishment wing of the party. But Texas has always been a state where even the true power on the Republican side, especially in North Dallas, certainly from the 60s and 70s, has had a very strong, robust, if you will, sense of conservatism. If you remember the book and the movie, Charlie Wilson's War, Charlie Wilson, former congressman from East Texas, appealed as part of his effort to get weapons to the Mujahideen, appealed in Houston to very far-right elements, not poor and bedraggled and disenchanted elements, but very wealthy elements who were the descendants of the John Birch Society philosophy that you suspect your federal government at all times. That attitude is very real and is very alive. It is not the dominant attitude here, but it certainly has an important place in Republican politics today.
And you have to add to Governor Greg Abbott's buying into this lunatic conspiracy theory, also Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who was asked about it. He went on to say that, quoting, "When the federal government has not demonstrated itself to be trustworthy in this administration, the natural consequences is that many citizens don't trust what it's saying." And he went on to say that he was going to look into it. So he's certainly not distancing himself from this Jade Helm 15 conspiracy theory.
You know, it's funny because the governor, after there was a bit of instant blowback from some Republicans and some others to the governor's announcement that, well, I'm going to have the State Guard monitor the affairs of this military operation. When that happened, the governor himself had a picture taken, posed over the weekend with some military veterans at the governor's mansion who were there for, who were in town for a prayer breakfast. And he, the governor, and his political operative have put those, tweeted those on Twitter and put them up on Facebook as a way of saying, now, wait a minute, we like the military as well, trying to have it both ways. But the thing that really strikes me was what you just said, and that's that Ted Cruz and the governor have not pulled back, beaten a hasty retreat in toto from this, but have simply tried to modify it by saying, well, you know, we don't trust the government, and all we're doing is just asking questions. And in so doing, they're sending a dog whistle to that part of the party, which obviously they think in Republican Party politics remains very, very strong.
And again, I'm speaking with Wayne Slater, who is a contributing writer to the Dallas Morning News. He was previously their senior political writer and for 15 years was the Austin bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. He's the co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestselling book, Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. And he has covered all of the governorships in Texas from Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, Rick Perry, and now Greg Abbott. So just to make sure that the audience knows what we're talking about here with this bizarre story, Operation Jade Helm 15 is a military exercise largely involving the special forces, and it covers, I think, about six states. They even had to have some Pentagon guy come and try and brief everybody to say that, you know, they weren't declaring war on Texas. But that apparently has not assuaged, and a lot of this stuff is being ginned up by right-wing radio and Dave Weigel and Alex Jones and other, you know, I can't remember the name of that other patriot group, Stuart Rhodes heads up. They're all sort of foaming at the mouth about this. And some of the theories that they have are just so extraordinary, how anybody would believe it. Apparently there's a deserted Walmart, and they think that they're tunneling under the Walmart to basically round up anybody who believes in the Second Amendment and put them in FEMA camps. I mean, is this all being discussed, the true scope of the lunacy of these conspiracy theories?
I think they're, look, this is not the face of Texas. Most people in Texas, to the extent that they've heard about this, and certainly people have in the last 24, 48 hours, are probably embarrassed by it. And to be fair, it's not the full, complete face of the Republican Party in Texas but it is an expression of, I think, a fairly significant minority position within the Republican Party. And the thing that strikes me as I look at this is that these kind of exercises have been going on for years over here. Over there, these sort of nutty, lunatic, fringe, Bertha Bircher secessionist folks have long spewed their theories of concentration camps to come, of martial law is on the horizon, and so forth and so on. What we haven't seen before, and certainly in a way that we've seen it in the last few days here in Texas, is a blending of this nutball fringe being offered some kind of relevancy by authorities, in this case the governor of Texas, suggesting, well, perhaps this is something we ought to look into. Ted Cruz, in his statement this weekend, you played the portion of it, or you referred to a portion of it, in South Carolina, was doing a couple of things. One of them was sending a signal to voters in South Carolina who could be potentially important to him. These would be conservative folks, who, some of whom are listen to the conservative paranoia machine that most folks have no idea is out there. But also, I think what Cruz was doing is saying we can't trust the federal government, or raising questions of doubt about the federal government. And he specifically said in the last 6 years. So this is a reference to Obama. And both Ted Cruz, our current governor, and I suspect some other Republicans who have not sort of recoiled in horror at this, the prospects of aligning yourself with the far fringe right, in effect are expressing attitudes about the government under Obama. And in Texas, among conservatives, that's the kind of thing that I think our governor thought, and Ted Cruz believes, he can certainly get away with saying bad things, in effect, about the government because the government is Barack Obama.
And, of course, the what they're banding about is those that are loyal and those that are disloyal. And, of course, the disloyalty is inherent in the idea that Obama is not a true American. He's from Kenya. He doesn't have a passport. And he's a Muslim. So, you know, the subtext is is not exactly well disguised here.
Well, and it's all, and it's also ugly. I mean, I go into East Texas, which is closer to obviously the Old South. It's on the Louisiana border, and I talk to people, and the residue of racial politics is still very much alive. Now, Texas is not, and many southern states are not the same as they were in the 50s in terms of racial attitudes, but there remains a strong racial bias, a bigotry, an aspect of attitudes about black people and to some extent, Hispanic Americans here that lives on today. People are slightly more polite about it. But it's impossible to look at the attitudes about Obama in a state like Texas, as it's associated with the federal government, and to discount any idea that some of this is race-based, because it is.
Well, the idea, and this is what they believe with Jade Helm 15, that this military exercise is obviously conducted by the Obama administration in conjunction with the U.S. military and Walmart, and they're planning to impose martial law on much of the country. And this plan also includes gun confiscation and secret underground tunnels, as I mentioned, from an abandoned Walmart being the ground zero. This has gone viral. They have videos, and they're sharing all this stuff. I've been hearing about it, so and I'm not.
You know, Ian, you would not have heard about this. We would not have heard about this had it not been for the governor giving it, appeared to give it some credence, that he felt comfortable enough to sort of offer a wink, wink, nudge, nudge attitude about this, that he did not think would come back and would politically hurt him. Because most of this stuff is on this crazy right-wing media, and I know you don't listen to it, but I have to tell you, I do. I listen to Alex Jones on television here. He lives here in Austin, Texas. I watch and I look at his website and try to make sense, and it's very difficult to make sense about the contradictions sometimes in the conspiracy theories and the elaborate nature of the theories that if you spin them out, as you just did, they're ridiculous on their face. And yet, just a few days ago in Bastrop County, not far from here, where some of this started, where the military sent this officer to come and talk to local landowners to reassure them of the idea, this is what we're going to do, there are going to be people, this is what the purpose of the exercise is. And what he got in that crowd of otherwise seemingly normal citizens was were questions about, well, we don't believe you. We think this is a prelude to martial law. We think this is perhaps something. And so when you talk to some of these people about the idea of taking abandoned Walmarts and turning them into FEMA concentration camps for political prisoners, it may sound crazy to you and to me and, frankly, to a lot of people in Texas, but there are a sizable number of folks on the conservative right, far right, who think that this is absolutely a possibility. And I think that's who the governor, though he may not, he may think it's ludicrous as well, that's who he was playing to in offering credence to this view.
And Senator Cruz as well.
And Senator Cruz as well. Now, not everybody has done this. As I mentioned...
Well, Rand Paul sort of said he'd look into it. I mean, he didn't dismiss it.
And let me tell you, a lot of these are Rand Paul people. There were certainly Ron Paul people. Ron Paul, very popular among the libertarian right here in Texas, obviously, and elsewhere in the country. But yeah, I mean, this is it may sound crazy when you're listening to it and you lay it all out, but when it comes against the backdrop of years and years of suspicion about the federal government, raising questions about whether the government under this president, and frankly, there were some of these people were critical of George W. Bush as well, as not conservative enough, as a government that might take your guns and take your liberty, then it's taken seriously. I can remember in 1988 when Michael Dukakis was running for president, and I went to East Texas, and all I heard in East Texas was unprompted. People would say, "I don't like Michael Dukakis," and this is in conservative Democrat quarters in the eastern part of the state. "I don't like Michael Dukakis because he's going to take our guns." When you link something like "they are going to take our guns," and now issues of religious liberty and property confiscation and other claims, then it isn't just something that arrived here yesterday. This is an attitude that is deeply ingrained among some elements of the population here. And all I can say is there are Republicans, who, including the former lieutenant governor here in Texas, and also Mac Thornberry, who's the chairman of the House Military Affairs Committee in the House, who said, wait a minute, this is a bridge too far. So not every Republican is on board here.
Sure. But it's gotten so nutty and pervasive that Walmart spokesman had to come out and say there's no truth to the rumors. But when you say you listen to Alex Jones here at the Pacifica, which is the network that I'm broadcasting on, is there elements in the Pacifica have bought into Alex Jones, hook, line, and sinker, and they've been running his film about 9/11, The Truth of Conspiracy. It's called Loose Change. You know, promoting the hell out of that.
Oh, I know about it. Oh, yeah. I know.
So it's not just lunatics on the right. Lunatics who think they're on the left also buy into Alex Jones's conspiracy theories.
And it gets to this question of why is it that we believe conspiracy theories, whether the classic ones about who shot Kennedy or various other things? Why is it that we, again, a lot of these people are on the right or far right, some, you're exactly right, are on the left. What is it about us and about the nature of the way we see the world that makes a certain people simply say, whatever seems to be the most reasonable explanation must be the wrong explanation. There must be something else out there. It's a complicated area, and I know there's been a lot of study about it, and I certainly am not smart enough or educated enough to know why, but I do know that there is this instinct to say whatever appears to be true is not true, and it plays right into this kind of grasping and accepting conspiracy theories, no matter how lunatic they sound.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Wayne Slater, just turning to the incident in Garland, Texas, one of the things that's really troubled me about it is that it was clearly a provocation. The idea that you organize an event that you pay $10,000 to the person who can draw the most sacrilegious and offensive cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad, and then, you know, a couple of hapless jihadis show up and take the bait. So it's one group of fanatics baiting another group of fanatics. And the minute that the Islamic State or the ISIL or whatever they want to call themselves in the Middle East claim credit for this, which probably, you know, they had no connection to it, but why not claim credit? Suddenly the whole story turns into the war on terror, and it's like everybody's swallowing it. I'm astounded.
Yeah, I really have mixed feelings. I think a lot of us do about this this business. Clearly Pamela Geller, who was an organizer of this event, was doing exactly that, to provoke an incident, an episode, something to bring attention to her group. That's scandalous, the idea that they would pay $6,000 to $10,000 for their security, and God bless them that they did have that kind of security out there, and that you would, I think you've put your finger on it, that they would lure a couple of hapless folks who've been brought in and radicalized on presumably online is laughable and is also quite tragic. But immediately on Fox News and elsewhere, this becomes another example of a larger theme against the backdrop of ISIS taking over. I think there's a fear. We know that there's a fear. You have it. I have it. Your listeners have it. A lot of people are concerned for their children, for themselves, and they understand the potential of radical folks who could come over here and cause real problems. But most people understand that we have a free speech tradition here, the constitutional tradition. It shouldn't allow this kind of expression if we need to, even if it's provocation. But the bigger problem is, I think, that we immediately interpret the events in Garland, Texas, as proof positive of the large war on terror, which is very much afoot in Texas, in the United States. It's here. There are problems. Of course there are ideological differences. But the idea that this confirms all the worst fears of the radical right and the need to deal with Muslims in a way that is certainly not American, the Muslim religion in a way that's not American, I think is one of the biggest tragedies.
Well, Wayne Slater, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wayne Slater, who is a contributing writer to the Dallas Morning News, and he was previously their senior political writer, and for 15 years was the Austin bureau chief. He's the co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. And Wayne Slater has covered the administrations of Texas governors Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, Rick Perry, and now Greg Abbott. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the press's focus on the shootout in Garland, Texas has changed the minute that the Islamic State claimed credit.
I learned. nothing I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and the chair of journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Good to be here with you, Ian.
And Mark, we're just discussing this with Wayne Slater, but my sense is that the press coverage of the recent shootout in Garland, Texas, suddenly seemed to be captured. It seems to be driven by the self-declared Islamic State, who are taking credit for the actions of these two hapless wannabe jihadis. And they've entirely changed the focus of the story, which, to my mind, was a story about one group of fanatics baiting another group of fanatics and putting public safety at risk. Now it's suddenly the latest chapter in the war on terror.
Well, I think it depends which media outlets you're looking at. It's not obviously the media is no more a monolith than any other sort of profession. I think the mainstream media, the elite media, New York Times, Washington Post, has, been somewhat skeptical of the claim that ISIS was actually behind it. And certainly the Times has pointed out that ISIS likes to claim credit for stuff it really didn't have anything to do with. You have some, cable TV and right-wing outlets are less judicious about this. CNN said that the attack fits the well-known pattern of ISIS recruitment and incitement. Well, inciting, arguably, maybe, but recruitment, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration from what we know at this point. They also quoted some unnamed official as saying that this is more than just inspired by ISIS. When you start getting in the position of quoting these anonymous law enforcement officials, you can get yourself into trouble because that's true with any source, anonymous or not, law enforcement or not. But there is a whole cottage industry in the anti-terrorism security complex in the U.S. that sort of has a vested interest in pumping up the problem.
Well, but the problem is one that that we're trying to grapple with. We're spending billions on. Boston was attacked in the marathon, and frankly, that just captured the entire country's attention for weeks on end. It's not as if that suddenly when these things happen that the attention doesn't turn. But nobody is organizing. They didn't certainly, as far as I know, the Boston bombers weren't getting messages and orders from anybody that we know of. But when you actually stage an event that is designed to provoke this kind of terrorist outrage in the hope that you'll attract some lunatic, which is what happened, that's another matter. I mean, it's bad enough having these things exist in the real world than having to manufacture a provocation.
Well, it clearly was a provocation. I mean, it was designed to be as insulting as possible, and it succeeded.
So, but into the broader question, though, Mark, how does the press deal with these incidents like the Boston Marathon bombing, in the sense that it captured the entire press for weeks on end, and when more often than not, when these things happen, whether it's a mass shooting in a movie theater or whatever, the person who perpetrates it suddenly becomes a kind of household name for a while. It just seems like in the case of the Charlie Hebdo in Paris, Again, the people that do this are a bunch of losers by and large. But they manage to capture the entire global media for days on end, and that seems to be their reward. That seems to feed in to what they want. And I'm wondering if there's any way not to take the bait.
Well, you know, certainly there are ways not to take the bait, but the news media has a bias toward the dramatic. Toward the sensational, and whether it's terrorist actions or school shootings, you get sort of disproportionate coverage for those kind of violent and extreme actions. And the press tends to ignore the more systemic problems of society, how many people die from lack of health care or die every year from, infections caught in hospitals. The numbers are, far greater, but it's not as dramatic a story. The visuals aren't as compelling, so that kind of stuff, even though it's more important, gets less attention often.
So in terms of then, as I say, I was watching evening news last night, CBS, and there was no mention of Pamela Geller's role in this. It was all about the Islamic State. And when you consider that Pamela Geller has, she's very public about what she believes, and she's written on her website, Atlas Shrugs, I should say. She said, for example, that President Obama is the illegitimate child of Malcolm X, had a sexual affair with a crack whore, wants jihadists to win, was not born in the United States, has never repudiated his Muslim faith, and that the raid on the bin Laden compound was carried out by a coup over the president's refusal to greenlight it. It's pretty clear where this woman's coming from, wouldn't you say, Mark?
Well, I wasn't familiar with the incidents you mentioned, but if all that's true, I think that's pretty clear.
Why do they put her on the media then? Why is she given all this ink and airtime?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. But I think, I think she wouldn't have been if there hadn't been violence there. But because there was, and she was the organizer, that's a natural thing for the media to look at. And to interview her, the question is they should be asking skeptical questions about her and her background and if this is what she wanted to accomplish. And in fact, some of the right-wing media have been pretty openly happy about it. I think there's something on Fox News about, that it's good to smoke these folks out. It was a good thing that this happened. So, that it's good to provoke this kind of thing to get it out in the open. So, clearly on that side of the spectrum, the logic and sanity don't matter. I mean, Rush Limbaugh was quoted as saying that, suggesting that Obama even gave the green light to the whole thing. So when you're dealing with that kind of a lunatic fringe, you're not going to get through and make sense. But you depend on the mainstream media to not give this kind of lunatic fringe more attention.
Well, but that seems to be a real problem we have as a society in general, that there's a kind of diminishing consensus on what is real and what is true. I mean, people get their information from where they choose to get it from. Christians from Christian television, liberals from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, and so on. Does it trouble you? I mean, how does one teach journalism students today to, basically seek out the truth and fact-based information when they may not be able to get a job in an organization that exists that cares about that? I know I'm being overdramatic.
And that pays for it. I mean, that's our job, and that's what we train our students to do. That's what I do and my colleagues work hard to do. It's true. The economic foundations of journalism are not what they used to be, and the jobs are not what they used to be. And as the market gets more fractionalized and people tune in to have their own prejudices reinforced, you get journalism that's more advocacy than fact-based news gathering. We've gone through this before in American history. In the early 1800s, newspapers were funded largely by partisan newspapers that were propaganda outlets. But the reach and the scope today with the technology is so much greater than it was a couple hundred years ago that the ramifications are a lot greater and more troubling.
And in terms of your book, Mark Feldstein, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture, it doesn't seem that that's abating in any way. It does seem, for example, you've got this Republican operative who's written this book about Hillary Clinton and in particular the Clinton Foundation, and he was recently out here at the Koch brothers organized event. They had a secret private event in Newport Beach where they pledged $1 billion to defeat Hillary. And he was, this author of this book was one of the speakers there, firing up the billionaires to write their checks. So it does seem that just out of the gate, they're going to try and revive the Clinton scandals, and I think in a week or so, I'm not sure exactly the date, the House is, they're still negotiating with Hillary Clinton over this Trey Gowdy Benghazi committee. They want her to testify in secret. She's smart enough to know that would mean that they could just cherry pick what she said and leak it to the press. So she's insisting on a public hearing, but they're going to revive that one again with some hacked emails, believe it or not, hacked by a Romanian hacker working for the Russian intelligence service. So I don't know. I get the feeling that all the way through to November 2016, it's just going to be, throwing scandal at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think, Watergate coverage really inaugurated, and ever since, that plus a lot of other things that I talk about in my book, has led to this rise of what I call the Washington scandal culture, 24/7 cable outlets trying to juice up their ratings, et cetera, the Internet. So, yeah, we're going to see that, and especially because Hillary Clinton has emerged as by far the dominant, if not likely, nominee for the Democratic Party. It makes her that much more of an individual target earlier. And as there was against her husband, there is a lot of big corporate sponsors who are going to pay for private eyes to go, dig into this stuff. Now, the Democrats do it, too. I don't think quite as with as deep pockets or quite as effectively, but they have so-called opposition researchers as well to look into the Republicans. But it's spread out now at this point, I think, over a lot more possible candidates, and probably won't focus too much until it becomes clear who the Republican nominee will be.
So I guess there's no turning back then.
I don't think so. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube. And, the other thing to remember is we can blame the political operatives and we can blame the media for it, and certainly they're profiting from it. But, if it didn't have some resonance with the public, it wouldn't work in the first place. If people actually preferred to hear more substantive coverage about less sexy topics instead of the latest fear du jour being inflamed by the media, then the media would adjust, You know, it's a for-profit making industry in this country in a capitalist society, by and large. There's some nonprofit, but mostly not. And so they're feeding the appetite of what the public wants, and the ratings go up accordingly. And if they didn't, they would go in another direction. So, you know, in a certain sense, all of us in the public bear some responsibility as well by enabling that in our viewing habits and our reading habits and our clicking habits.
Well, Mark Feldstein, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and the chair of journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal that appears to be losing momentum.
Money makes the world go around. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Clyde Prestowitz, who's the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, and his latest, The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clyde Prestowitz.
Great to be with you.
And TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, appears to be stalled in the Senate because Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid is putting the brakes on, saying that until the Senate deals with the stalled infrastructure bill and reforming the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, they're not going to help pass this. The Republicans apparently pretty much want to pass it in league with the White House, which in itself is an unusual coalition, wouldn't you say?
It's a very unusual coalition. It really is. And I think, actually, however, that the fate of the TPP is going to be decided more in the House than in the Senate.
And why do you say that?
Well, I think that there is probably a majority in the Senate. The question is there a big enough majority to break a filibuster? And I guess eventually there is. But in the House, it's not at all clear. It appears that a majority of the House actually just doesn't want the TPP at all for different reasons. There is a group of Republicans who don't want it because they think that it would somehow expand the president's power, and they don't want to give him anything, Obama, that is. And on the other hand, the vast bulk of the Democratic members of the House think that the deal would be bad for the average American, for working people. And so they really fundamentally oppose their own president on this issue.
Well, I think that a lot of the Democrats, obviously it's often reported that the trade unions are against it, although the trade unions have less and less power in the country and less influence in the Democratic Party. But how much are Democrats operating on previous trade deals and what they've done? How clear is the record with NAFTA and CAFTA and other trade deals that at the end of the day, critics of these trade deals are proven right?
Well, let's take the most recent one, which is the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. It was passed in 2012, so 3 years ago. At the time it was passed, the arguments then were very similar to those today. The White House, that's President Obama, were saying, oh, this is an up-to-date deal. It's modern. It's fantastic. It's not like CAFTA. It's not like NAFTA. It's going to reduce the U.S. trade deficit with Korea. It's going to open the Korean market for American exports. It's going to create thousands of good American jobs. That was the argument. And plus, it's going to cement our geopolitical relationship with Korea. So all the same arguments are being made today. Now, if you look at the actuality of what's happened in the past 3 years, our trade deficit with Korea has about tripled. U.S. exports in not just in percentage terms, but in absolute terms have fallen to Korea. And we've had a net loss of jobs rather than a net increase of jobs. So I think a lot of Democrats and others, I mean, I think Republicans too, are looking at that. They're looking at the bringing China into the World Trade Organization. That happened in 2002. At that time, our trade deficit with China was $80 billion. And our leaders, Nikki Cantor was the trade representative, Clinton and then Bush were the presidents. And they went up on the hill and they told the Congress that China has higher barriers to trade than we do. Bringing them into the WTO will reduce their barriers disproportionately. It'll cut our trade deficit. It'll create thousands of American jobs. It will be a great thing. Well, our trade deficit with China today is about $400 billion. It's estimated that 3.2 million American manufacturing jobs have gone to China. So I think, you know, a lot of congressmen are looking at that record and saying, oh, man, you know, the president said it's going to be different this time, but just exactly how is it going to be different? And the difficulty is that the truth is, if you look at the contents of the proposed TPP, it's not very different.
So then why is there this momentum? If this is not going to do what it's advertised and will end up doing the opposite, where does the momentum come from?
Well, you mean to pass it. You know, why is it, you're asking me why is the White House pushing it?
Yeah, why is this? It's not just the White House.
It's the whole foreign policy community. Yeah, the Council of Foreign Relations and the global corporations, the CEOs, the Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce. They're all pushing it, and there are two reasons. Let me start with the latter first. The big corporations are pushing it because the deal provides elements. I mean, for the pharmaceutical companies, for example, there are elements in the deal which would, in effect, allow them to charge higher prices for pharmaceuticals in foreign countries. There are elements in the deal that purport to provide greater intellectual property protection. So remember, these are global corporations, so they operate in many foreign countries, and this deal might make their life better in those countries. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to export anything more from the United States or that they're going to create more American jobs. In fact, by making their life easier in the foreign countries, it typically encourages more investment and offshoring from the U.S. So the corporations like it because it may be good for them. That doesn't mean it's good for the American worker. The second element is that the foreign policy community, the Council of Foreign Relations, and a lot of foreign policy gurus are still living in an era of American hegemony, American dominance. They're not thinking about this deal in economic terms. In fact, to make this very clear, I was invited personally to the White House around 2009 when this deal was being cooked up, to be consulted on what the deal was about. And I asked the White House advisors at the time, what is the main purpose of the deal? And the answer to me was not to create American jobs. It was to reassure our allies in Asia that we're back and that we are concerned about them and that we're pivoting to them. So it was a geopolitical objective, not an economic objective. And the foreign policy community in the U.S. is mainly interested in geopolitics, not in economics. And so they're pushing it because they think that this will somehow strengthen our alliance with Japan and the Philippines. Well, the Philippines is not in the deal. So, I mean, that's another strange thing. Actually, none of our allies are in the deal except Japan.
Well, but we've just started out by talking about how Harry Reid has thrown a spanner in the works and slowed it down in the Senate. Recently, the Japanese Prime Minister came to Washington. He spoke before the Congress, met at the White House, and they were trying to hash out the last-minute disagreements between Japan and the United States over the TPP, which apparently to do with protectionism here on the U.S. auto companies and protectionism in Japan with their agricultural sector. Was that resolved?
Apparently not yet. I haven't heard any word that it has been resolved, no.
Right. So why then, what's your sense then? Because there's so many people that I know that just think that this thing is so terrible they're quite mobilized to stop it. And it sounds as if it's sort of grinding to a halt under its own weight.
I have the same sense. I've watched a lot of these debates over the last 35 years, and I would say this is the first one in which I thought, gee, you know, maybe the White House is not going to get what it wants. I do have the sense, as you said, that maybe it's a bridge too far.
So where do you think then the future lies in terms of this pivot to Asia? It's a bit odd to have a pivot to Asia.
Well, you know, to be honest, I've never understood what was meant by the pivot to Asia. We have had the Seventh Fleet in Asia for 75 years. We've had 100,000 troops in Asia for 75 years. You know, there's this myth that somehow we left Asia. I never thought we left. We have enormous trade with Asia. We have enormous trade deficits with Asia. We have enormous investment in Asia. So I never understood. I mean, it seemed to me we were already there. So I never understood the pivot. I think it's unfortunate terminology. And it implies, as you said, a confrontation with China that we don't need and that is not, at all called for.
Well, I suppose in defense of the administration, what they might have meant was that we're sick of getting bogged down in the Middle East in these fruitless, endless, right. Pointless wars that cost us enormous amount of treasure and lives, and we just keep getting sucked further in. But on the other hand, Clyde Prestowich, you could make the argument that given what just happened in Washington between the U.S. and Japan in terms of strengthening defense commitments, do you see a scenario similar to the beginning of World War I where the U.S. could be dragged into a wider war in Asia over a pile of rocks in the East China Sea that China and Japan are squabbling over?
Well, precisely. I do see that. I fear that. We unilaterally guarantee Japan's security, and Japan has claims that are of absolutely no meaning or significance to us, like the Senkaku Islands. And these claims, of course, conflict with Chinese claims. The Chinese and the Japanese are squabbling over that. This is not our squabble. But by dint of our security guarantee to Japan, we get dragged into it. There are many other potential things like that. And I really think we need to carefully review exactly who is doing what for and to whom in these security agreements.
Well, but rather than pull back, we've actually dug the hole deeper, haven't we, with these
yes,
new
we
commitments?
Have. Yes. Yes, we have. Yeah, I'm afraid we have.
So just in closing then, what's your sense of where this, you're saying that the TPP is really going to come in up against a brick wall in the House. It's already been stalled in the Senate, and a big centerpiece in the TPP is the US-Japan agreement, and that didn't happen as a result of Abe's recent trip to Washington. And yet the real brick wall will be in the House. So this looks like it's going to be dead on arrival.
Well, we don't know. I mean, the history of these is over the past 50 years has been that trade deals have become increasingly controversial, and they've become increasingly hard to pass. But they have all passed. So if this doesn't, it'll be the first time since the end of the war, of the Second World War. And so, you know, one hesitates to bet against it. But on the other hand, you know, as I said, it's been getting harder and harder, and this one is looking like it's very hard. So it'll be very interesting to watch.
But that doesn't mean that we're heading back into a kind of Smoot-Hawley era, does it?
Oh, no, heavens no. No, it's living a completely different world. I think what it means is that we're maybe at the end of an era in which the United States, kind of because of its overwhelming both economic and strategic superiority, the U.S. was willing to make, let's say, disproportionate economic concessions in order to obtain geopolitical objectives. And maybe we're coming to the end of that era, and the U.S. will have to think more carefully about, let's say, geoeconomics, and not simply assume that all of these deals are necessarily going to be good for the average American, and put more focus on future deals and what's really good for the average American as well as for other participants in the deal.
Well, Clyde Presswitz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Clyde Presswitz, who's a former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nations, and his latest, The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.